You are listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment, a podcast brought to you by Migrants Organise. Throughout this series, we hope to shine a light on the realities of the UK's immigration and asylum system, explore the pressure and anguish it puts upon people who go through it, while also hearing about hopeful and powerful acts of migrants and community organising. Each episode will focus on a different aspect of the UK's asylum system. On today's episode, I talk to Hope about her experiences battling the Home Office while going through serious cancer treatment, raising a daughter and experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. We talk about how she found strength in her faith, in her community, and in the help provided by Migrants Organise, particularly her support worker, Francesca. Listeners should be aware this episode contains extensive discussion of suicide and female genital mutilation, otherwise known as FGM. If you are affected by any of the issues discussed, you can speak to the Samaritans 24/7 on 116 123 or the Refugee Council Helpline on 0808 196 7272. Their phone line is open on Monday, Tuesday and Thursday mornings. We hope you enjoy the show. If you would like to leave us any feedback, you can find ways to contact us in the show notes. I am joined by Hope. Hope, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Could you introduce yourself briefly for the listeners?
My name is Hope. I always start by saying a woman, a strong Black woman, a mother and a wife.
So would you be able to tell us a little bit about your journey as a migrant in the UK?
Okay, thank you. I came to the UK in 2004 with my husband. I was invited by my elder brother, who's British. He was born here. And we came in after we got married, myself and my husband, just to stay for a while because there were issues back home. When we came, arrived in the UK, barely 3 to 4 weeks, things happened between myself, my husband and the wife. And we were kicked out, and basically we were homeless. We found space to live with friends and families from church. It was very uncomfortable sofa surfing with families. My in-law, my brother-in-law, my husband's brother lived in the EU then. So he was able to come to the UK because he knew the situation we were in. And then he came in, lived here. So we could live with him and make the situation a bit easier on us. In 2007, I had my daughter who was still living with my brother-in-law. He was the only one who was allowed to work. So he was basically looking after the family. And when I had my daughter, we applied. Immediately, the application was refused. And in 2010, I became very ill. I was diagnosed with cancer. And that just turned my life upside down. Growing up, what I knew about cancer was you have cancer, you will die. So that was what I was seeing. I was seeing myself as this is it, I will be dead. I was battling the Home Office, not having my rights to live in the country, not because I wanted to overstay my visa, but because things happened.
When you have your cancer diagnosis, how did the Home Office react to that?
Oh, I would say it was the worst experience of my life. Mm-hmm. I don't wish that on anyone, anybody. And thinking about it now, I just say whoever made those decisions, when those people, I don't think they are human. I think the solicitor we had them wrote to the Home Office to say, this is the situation now. And they refused. They said, no, I'll have to go back to Nigeria. When I was in the hospital, I was told I had to pay for my treatment. And bearing in mind, I didn't work. I didn't have the right to work. I was there. I had a child who wasn't even 3 years old. And they gave me the bill then. It was over £10,000 for the operation, the scans, the MRIs, everything, the biopsy, everything I had.
While you were still sick?
While I was sick. In fact, the day I had a 10-hour operation, the next day, this lady came to me by my bedside and said, I had to sign these bills. And she gave me different papers to sign the bills. And I looked at her, I burst into tears. And she said, well, if you don't sign because you don't have a right to stay in this country, you might be deported and your treatment would stop. So my brother-in-law kindly signed that he would be responsible for the money. They said, because we don't have the money to pay, put down the down payment, and they agreed for him to make a monthly payment, which he did. I made a promise to him because it was kind. Whenever I get my status, I will, from that day, make sure I am responsible for the bills, which I do till this day. My doctors, my consultants, they were fantastic. When I had this lady from the overseas department come in, I cried to them. And I remember one of the consult. I had three surgeons when I had my operation, so I was seeing the three of them. And one of them looked at me, and one of the breast care nurses said to me, we don't work for the Home Office. Right. We're doctors. We're here to treat. And our job, what we were trained to do, is to look after patients, and we don't care where the patients come from. When I had a cancer diagnosis, it came as a shock to me. And of course, nobody wants to be diagnosed with cancer. And for me, coming from a country where there's still a stigma attached to cancer, and me living in a country where at that time I was struggling, I didn't have my papers, I think my life was just upside down. I was a mess. I cried more than I smiled. I think I would say I lived a double life then. I went to the church because that was my only hope. But in the church, I would smile and come back home and cry. I think then my daughter saw me crying more than she saw me smiling as a young child. My mental health was all over the place. I think, looking back now, it's funny because I was suicidal, to be honest. There was this day where I actually wrote down a suicide note.
Right.
Now I know it's a suicide note. But then it was just too much for me because the Home Office was saying you have to go back with your child. Everything I said was a lie. And as a child, I went through FGM. And I had an expert report. I had checks done from a notable doctor. And all the reports were sent to the Home Office. And they said, no, you have to take your child back to Nigeria, although my child was born in the UK. So I just felt like, oh, my God, I need protection from someone here. I just need somebody to listen to me. So it was too much for me to handle. Although at this time, I had migrants organized. I had Francesca, who I could call any day, anytime. This woman was there 100%. But being alone felt overwhelming. I wrote down this note, and I still remember what I put down. I said, please look after my child if I die, because I'm not sure if I would survive this. And signed it off. And somehow my husband found the notes, and he actually went with me to my GP the next time I went there and told the GP. And I finally got help from my GP and the hospital as well. I was referred by my consultant from the hospital to see a psychiatrist.
How old were you when you were diagnosed?
I think I was 30. I had my daughter 29, 30, 31. I think 31, 32.
That's so young, yeah. And you've got a very young child.
Yeah. I think that was my greatest fear. I wasn't scared of losing my life, although nobody wants to die. I was scared of dying because I wasn't sure what that would look like. But I was more scared of not being there for my daughter. But I think the most difficult part wasn't the cancer, it was the home office. It was just too much. It was too much, too much. At one point, I did ask if these people are human, because I was told that it doesn't matter if you're diagnosed with cancer, you have to be dying for your case to be reviewed, or for you to win your case or something. You have to be on your dying bed. But who wants to die first? Everyone wants to live. I remember having when I had an emergency operation, we were going to the home office to report at the home office, my daughter, my husband. And when I was in the hospital, I had an emergency operation. My husband called them, and the solicitor wrote to the home office saying I was in the hospital, and they said, well, I still have to come and sign. So I had to go to the home office with a colostomy bag with my daughter. And the treatment there was just, oh my God. My daughter was searched. She was, the way they searched a child, like she was a criminal. And she still talks about it till this day. Everything, she still remembers everything. Children don't forget. She remembers everything, although she has a British passport now. But to her, it doesn't really matter, because of, she said to me once, if I have a British passport and people don't have, of what use is my British passport? There's this fear they instill in you that makes you think if you don't do what they say, and it's control. I see it as control. Mental control. If you don't do what we say, you will be removed from this country, and there's nothing you can say, and there's no one who can say otherwise.
It sounds terrifying, you know, constantly being worried about being removed from the country.
Yeah.
I know people who would go to these weekly check-ins, and you would be led through a slightly different set of double doors, and that's how they would deport you. So just going for the check-ins can be very scary in itself, can't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was so scared, because sometimes I would say to my husband, I don't know if today will be the last day. But whenever, it's funny now, whenever we would go to the home office, we would make sure we call Francesca, and she would say, let me know before you get in the home office, and let me know when you come out and all that. Thank God, at some point, we did win the case and we're allowed to stay in the country. Yeah.
How long were you waiting to hear about your leave to remain?
I think it took about... there was a breakthrough in the case. If not, it would have taken longer. It took about 7-8 years, I think. But at that time, our daughter turned 7. And we had one of the barristers for Migrants Organized, fantastic. She helped us get a pro bono barrister. So they helped us with the case. So when my daughter turned 7, that was when things changed, basically. Yeah. If not, we would have waited for longer.
We know it's very hard for migrants and asylum seekers to just get by in the UK, not being able to work, as you've mentioned, or claim benefits. So how did you cope? What was your story?
Yeah. So when we first made the application, we didn't know where or how to get support from the world. We knew we were not allowed to claim any benefits. Francesca did, from Migrants Organized, did explain to us the options we had. And she spoke to the solicitor we had then, because we had an accommodation. We were not homeless at that point. They made an application to the Home Office for us to get subsistence only support, which we did. And we did get support from Migrants Organized, obviously. They were giving out food vouchers to us almost every fortnight, whenever I needed.
Right.
And they did, and they did before I forget, because we lived very far from the office. They did signpost us to a local charity, which we're still in touch with as friends now, who came in, visited us, brought food, and whenever there was celebration, my daughter's birthday, they'll bring in cake, card, and presents for her.
Migrants organized, were able to help you apply for the subsistence.
Yes, true, from the Home Office. Yes.
Right, but that's something you had to apply for, which I'm sure wasn't easy.
Oh, it wasn't, because, we were told that because we applied does not mean it would be granted. So there was a lot of paperwork Francesca did to make sure they agreed to give the subsistence only, which they did. But they did stop it sometimes for no reason. I'll get to the post office to collect the money, and they will say, no, the Home Office collected the money back or something. I wasn't able to collect the money anyway. So I would have to go back to my solicitor or ring Francesca, and she would have to ring the Home Office, and they would say, well, I need to explain who's where we're getting accommodation from. But all these details they have already. So they wanted updates like every month of where we lived, the school my daughter was going to, the hospital I was attending. They had all the information. Without notice, they would stop the money they were giving. So in a way, I just felt like, you know what? You give somebody money, in a way, you're punishing me, because I'm really stressed.
Yeah.
Stressed, because I will have to walk from my house to the post office at that time, which would take me about an hour, hoping there will be money there waiting for me. And get to the post office, nothing. I would have to go back home and wait till the next week before I go back to the Home Office. It was horrible. And for me, my mental health suffered a lot, because when I was diagnosed with cancer, I did open up a lot of wounds. Initially, I did mention FGM. And I had, I didn't know I had this fear of scissors and blades. So it was when I was referred to a psychiatrist by my consultant. We did talk about all these things. And I was having flashbacks from the FGM. If someone told me I would suffer that much from something that happened to me as a child, I would say, no, it's just something that happened. It's cultural, it's what they do to girls. But it did have a big impact on my life. To the extent where I was scared of getting close to older women that looked like the person that actually had me caught as a child. So it did impact on a lot of things, and my mental health suffered a lot. At that point, I just felt like FGM, me being stuck in this country, now cancer, was there to live for. There's nothing to fight for. After, I didn't really think about it much when I had the surgery, but it was the aftercare that did scare me a lot. Because when I had the surgery, of course, I was asleep. I didn't know what was going on. But the aftercare, I would see when I had my dressings changed and all that. That was where I knew I was struggling. And physically shaking sometimes. And I just did not want to say anything to anyone. But I had a fantastic psychiatrist. And I still have till today. Changed everything about how I see things.
Throughout our interview, Hope talked about how her faith had been a source of strength during very challenging moments. I asked her to tell us a bit more about her faith and how it related to her mental health.
I've always believed from a very young age that there's a God somewhere, because I'm a Christian. And I believe, even though I'm a Christian, that does not exempt me from the trials of life. But it will not be unto death. Even if it's unto death, you will find help at some point in your life. And that's how I process me going through cancer, the immigration, everything, and finding help for migrants organized. I just believe, because when I was in the hospital, I prayed a lot. I had my Bible. I had books, religious books I read. And that was my only hope. And I cried every day for somebody somewhere to show me favor, because I couldn't help myself. I'm stuck in a country where I don't know anyone. I don't have a family, although I have a brother, but I see myself as I don't have anyone. But yeah, help did come. Although I went through difficult times, my mental health suffered. Thank God I didn't kill myself. I'm still here to tell the story. And while I was waiting, while myself and my family were waiting, I went to the home at the office, migrants organized, almost every day, because I didn't have anywhere to go to. That's one positive, how they helped my mental health.
Mm.
Apart from being religious.
What impact do you think that all of these experiences had on your family?
Well, when it comes to my husband, he did really talk about how he was feeling then.
Right.
It's only now. I think he spoke to Francesca more. He did talk to Francesca, opened up to Francesca. But with me, it was difficult for him to tell me how I was feeling, which I understand, because I had my own issues as well. I had the cancer to deal with, and I had a young child. And he didn't really talk about it that much. But now I understand the impact the old thing had on him. And he was thinking about him not losing his wife and being able to cope with a young child. How will he manage the whole situation? It's easy to say now, but as a family, there were times where we just felt like, let's just go our separate ways, because this is too much on us as a family.
Yeah.
It was hard. And for my daughter, I know she still remembers everything that we went through, how we went to the home office, how she came with me to the hospital, when she saw me with tubes and everything. She still remembers everything. And yeah, it's been negative, 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 but I try so hard to hold on to the positives, because I found a family I've never had. And the home office, as far as I know, is still the same. I pray they change, because what they do is driving people to take their own lives. And I would have been one of those people, if not that I got the support from a charity organization, I would have been dead.
Well, let's talk about Migrants Organize then. So let's talk about what you've done with Migrants Organize since 2011.
So when I went there, I immediately got a mentor. She became a mother figure in my life. I was with her. She mentored me for about 1 year, and I was told to be a mentor myself. And I asked if I would be able to do it. And I remember Francesca saying, don't worry, if you need help, well, don't worry, I'm always here. You can talk to me, but I will guide you on what to do. That would help you. You're helping someone and helping yourself. It would be nice for you to have somebody outside the office. So I did. I did embrace the opportunity, and I became a mentor. And that did take my mind off waiting for the home office. So when we got all these refusals and all these letters, I wasn't really bothered, because I had something positive to do. I was contributing, helping someone then, and helping myself. The mentoring projects is basically where I just step in as a friend, sort of, to my mentees, well, in a professional way. And make sure I keep in touch with them. And they're mainly vulnerable people. In some cases, single mothers who are still waiting for their status. And some of them have their status. I've mentored a couple in the past. And I did make phone calls because their English wasn't good. So I did mostly, almost everything. We went out for teas, coffees, for a meal that was paid for by migrants organized. And there was a budget for that as well. So it was basically like a befriending and moral support. I ran a group as well. I was part of the women's group in the past, where we just had women who were refugees and asylum seekers coming together. That was years ago, where we just shared our stories. We had women from different parts of the world, from Afghanistan and Pakistan, where we did share our stories and support each other as strong women then. And some of them I'm still in touch with. And I did facilitate a group as well with one of our members as well. We had a group where we were the facilitators. We had members that came together. We ran different activities for the groups.
What was it like when you were mentoring? How did that make you feel?
Well, I saw it first as a privilege to have the opportunity to be part of someone's space and life. It did open my eyes deeper to what people actually go through, apart from my experience. So I have different things to say about them, how the system has failed them. And they did get the support from migrants organized. And in one case, I was involved in a child protection case with a child and the council and social services. So it's opened my eyes to different aspects of the system and how things are done.
Has any of your work mentoring people helped you to reflect on your own experiences?
Yes, that's the reason I call them sisters, because we have, although we are different, but we have one thing that binds us all together. That's the experience we all share. And that experience is the experience from the Home Office. And what binds us together is the battle between us and the Home Office.
Would you say that hearing how the Home Office has treated other people you're mentoring has given you a better understanding of it?
Well, it's not giving me a better understanding. I'm still trying to get my head around how they behave.
Right. Yeah, I see.
Because I think it's gotten worse, to be honest. Every day I see and hear news about the Home Office, I'm still in shock how people are being treated. And I still can't understand why. Everything is just a fight. Everything. You would have to fight to get your leave to remain. You have to fight to get your housing, benefits, everything. I'm not saying everyone that works in the Home Office is bad. But with my experience and my family's experience, I can say I had only about a handful of people that just treated us like humans. But with my experience and what I know, I just feel like, why are you this way? And why have you been trained to actually inflict unending pain on people? It doesn't make any sense to me, because at the end of the day, you keep someone, treat them like animals, like they are not humans, and you mess up their mental health, and they will end up back in the system, and the NHS will pick up the mess. That's something they don't understand. There's no way you keep somebody waiting for 10, 15, 20 years and you expect them to be happy. They will be angry.
You are currently part of the crisis grant panel at Migrants Organise.
Yes.
Could you tell us how you became involved?
I was asked to be part of the Emergency Grants Committee, the Hardship Fund Grants Committee. It was a great honor, because I was there before. I was once that person that was supported by grants like this. So when I was told, to me, it was just a big privilege to be part of the Hardship Fund Committee, where we check applications. The caseworkers do send in applications, and we would have to check to see if we were okay with the cases. And then we had valid reasons why we should agree for the funds to be given out to each member. And these are people without recourse to public fund or asylum seekers.
Have you got any examples of when a grant's really helped somebody?
Apart from myself.
Well, tell us about your example.
Okay. So when, the hardship grant did help us in so many ways. I think the hardship grant was, I think I got a grant from the hardship fund to pay for my course, my health and social care course at Lewisham College then. I think so. And there were times where we had to apply for things, passports, I think for clothes, uniforms for my daughter when she was in school. And one of the ladies I mentor, when she got, she was going to apply for her kids' passports. I think we got grants. She got grants from the hardship fund as well, because her papers relied, her leave to remain will rely on the children's British citizenship. Mm-hmm. So the grants did help her get the passport for the kids for her to get her leave to remain.
Brilliant. It sounds like those grants are just the push that maybe you needed in certain situations to get you over.
Mm-hmm. And it does serve as emergency ways where people are homeless, like street homeless.
Yeah. But it's also, I mean, so when you say crisis grant, that would be what I assumed it was, right? That I would assume it would be to stop people from going homeless, to stop people from starving. Yeah. But the fact that it's also used to pay for your course, I think that's really, really good. Yeah, it's really, because that, you know, your course has led to what your sort of job is now, right?
Yeah, and it did. I think then the reason, now looking back, I think because I was really messed up in my head. So I think Francesca knew I needed to do something. So in a way, I wasn't looking, because the long-term benefits of me working wasn't, I didn't see me working at that time, but I needed to be around people. I think the benefits was more mental than getting a job. So me going to the college then did help my mental health, because I did get out of the house. And I did forget this. They paid for childcare for my daughter as well, because while I was studying, they paid for childcare for my daughter. Hmm. So I could go to college. Yes.
I mean, thanks so much for sharing everything you've shared so far. This might be a difficult question, but do you think that there's a silver lining in any of this? Something you've learned about yourself, or maybe something you've learned about people, which you'd like to share?
Let me first touch on what I've learned about people. I think from my experience, I've learned that those that genuinely love you and want to fight for you, no matter what happens, they will stick by. They will be there. They will be your ride or die. They will be that person that would say, no matter what it takes, I will stick my neck in. And those that are against you, they just do not want to know. And I've seen both sides. Mm-hmm. That's the reason I'm saying this. From the home office, from doctors. I had a consultant say to me once, why don't you go to South Africa and get your cancer treatment? And this is a consultant from a big hospital in London, a psychiatrist. She said, well, the issues you're having is not because you have, you were referred to me, not because you have, you're struggling with the cancer, it's because you have issues with the home office. And why don't you go to South Africa to get your cancer treatment? And you know what? You can't really fight the system. That was the last word she said. So now looking back, I just feel like that lady, whoever she is, still remember the name? She wasn't meant to be for me. And I still have somebody who's a consultant who's been there for so many years. That's something I've learned about people. I don't waste my time anymore. If you genuinely love me, you will stand by me. And if you see something good in me as a person, you will invest your time. That's how I feel. And my experience, I've learned that no matter how tough your situation is, if only you can hang on there, there will be hope and light at the end of the tunnel. Because my situation, I would say, was hopeless. But for me to be here, that means somebody somewhere was looking down on me, and migrants organized did a great job to see me through till this day.
Have you got a message for anybody who is still waiting for their status?
One thing I would say is do not keep quiet. Wherever you go, make noise, not noise in a bad way. Speak up, speak to people, ask questions. It might sound stupid, but go to the hospital, ask anybody, ask your GP, because that's how I got help. Somebody one day will listen and say, I know of somebody who can help you. But do not keep things to yourself. Just open up and help will come. One day, even if people don't listen, there will be somebody somewhere one day that will listen. It might sound stupid asking or saying, I've got this issue. It's difficult sometimes, but if you find the ones you trust, because we all have instincts, if you find the one you trust, then do not keep things to yourself. And definitely things will open up. And do not give up. Do not end it. Keep fighting. You will get there.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode. Hope, have you got any final thoughts that you wanted to share with us before you go today?
I hope everything we've talked about today would help someone stay sane and be on the right path. I know it's easy to say now, and I'm smiling now, but it wasn't like this before. Just hang on there. There will be light at the end of the tunnel. If I can make it, anyone can. Because my case was just useless. I was that rejected one, but I'm still here, still fighting. So you can, everyone can. If I can do it, you can. Thank you.
Thank you, Hope. Okay,
Thank
well,
you.
thank you so much for joining us today,
Thank
and do
you.
take care.
I
Okay,
will do. Thank
thank
you.
you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment. Today's show was brought to you by Migrants Organise, a platform for refugees and migrants to organise for power, dignity and justice to enable meaningful inclusion and integration. They combine advice and support for individuals affected by the hostile environment immigration policy with community organising, advocacy, research, and campaigning to dismantle structural racism. The theme song for this episode is Conform or Be Cast Out by Of Moy Om.